The White Network presents Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn. Your host, Carolyn Yeager.
Good day, listeners, and thanks for joining me on this beautiful Saturday afternoon. It's beautiful where I am, and it's almost afternoon if you're on the West Coast, and it's Saturday evening if you're in Europe or the British Isles. But it is February 15th, which is my mother's birthday. But it is also 2014, and she is no longer among the living. But before I go on with that, I want to not forget to thank Jaime Schwartz for his donation. Once again, he's become a real regular, and I look forward to getting something in the mail from him now every month. So thank you very much, Jaime. Let me start out by saying that when this year of 2014 began, I said on the air that an important focus for me in this year was going to be to answer, refute, correct, and do those things about the many lies and or misinformation sometimes that circulate about the National Socialist period in Germany under Adolf Hitler. So today I will be doing just that with the very able Margaret Hufstickler. Margaret did such a great job on the Heretics Hour last Monday that I asked her to come back today to not just do more justice to the controversy over the National Alliance and Kevin Alfred Strom business than she was able to do on that program, but to help me talk about the lie problem in general. And so here she is. Welcome, Margaret.
Thanks very much. I'm very happy to be back again.
Okay. There's a lot I'd like to cover as usual, so I thought it would be better to get some of the lighter business out of the way first. So we've agreed to start with the Monuments Man movie and then move on to the Gestapo and finish up with the white nationalist stuff. Right?
You haven't?
Yeah. Okay. Are you moving things around or you haven't?
Yeah, I just moved something in a drawer. There now, I shut the drawer. I was looking for a pencil in case I wanted to take notes.
Okay. Well, I wanted to talk about the Monuments Man movie, and it's been talked about very well. But I'm going to read, just to start out, Margaret and listeners, I'm going to read a very short, a little review that is kind of the official review, I guess. I found it by Googling the movie, and on the page with all the search results is. Was this, and it was given, the movie was given 3.5 out of 5 stars by the IMDb, that's that internet movie review site.
I think they were being kind.
Well, yeah, I mean, they usually will give 5 stars or something to these big Hollywood movies, but they didn't do it to this one, only 3.5 out of 5, which looked kind of paltry. But the other one was by Rotten Tomatoes, and they only gave it 1.5 stars out of 5. So it's already recognized that it's not that good. But it what they say here is based on the true story. And notice that they use the term based on because it's not a true story. And they can't, say it is. But people are fooled by things like this. And when you read based on the true story, you get the message, it's a true story, right? I mean, this is the way they...
Yeah, they said true story, didn't they?
They what?
They said true story, so...
Yeah. The true story, based on the true story of the greatest treasure hunt in history. The film is an action drama. So now, again, it's a drama. It's an action drama focusing on an unlikely World War II platoon tasked by FDR. I'm sure he did that personally, huh? With going into Germany to rescue artistic masterpieces from Nazi thieves and returning them to their rightful owners. Well, there's a problem because they did not return stuff to rightful owners, but that's what they make out that they were doing. It says it would be an impossible mission with the Ark trapped behind enemy lines and with the German army under orders to destroy everything as the Reich fell. Well, that's controversial. There were no orders. There were some orders to destroy some things, but there was no order to destroy everything. But that's the way they want to present it. And they say, how could these guys, 7 museum directors, curators, and art historians, all more familiar with Michelangelo than with the M1, some kind of a gun, possibly hope to succeed? But as the monument's men, as they were called, found themselves in a race against time to avoid the destruction of 1,000 years of culture, well, there's a big lie. They would risk their lives to protect and defend mankind's greatest achievements. God. Well, what do you think of that, Margaret? They had to avoid the destruction of 1,000 years of culture because Hitler was going to destroy it all himself.
Oh, yeah, that's what Hitler liked to do, is bomb museums, like loot art museums, as in Iraq. That was what Hitler did.
Yeah, the irony is that not only were the Americans the biggest thieves of all, followed exactly. by the Russians, but that the British and Americans destroyed more culture and art in Germany than Hitler ever could or would. Today is actually the last day of the official Dresden bombing, the 13th to the 15th.
God, yeah.
And look what they did there. And it was totally unnecessary. There was no reason to do it, but they just flattened the greatest culture city in Germany like that. And both the British and the Americans.
That's all an example of what Hervé Riesen calls the accusatory inversion. Accuse others of the crimes you do, which is also a Marxist dictum.
Yes, and this is what we find all the time when we're looking at all these, what I just simply call lies. and it was actually Hitler and the National Socialists who were trying to save the art by storing it away in salt mines. You know,
exactly.
So here we have this whole movie is just based on this big lie. Now, if you've got something you want to say or read or whatever, talk about this film. I've got just something that Further Glory at Scrapbook Pages said, a bunch of things that he wrote in a review that show that the movie's a lie.
A quick not quote from Edda Mussolini, who was talking about Goering, and she said, you know, he had his house near the Berghof was used for official receptions, so he had lots of beautiful art in it. And Edda Mussolini wanted to say, for the record, that he did not steal any of that art, of course. He bought the art that he had, which was the case. They had laws against looting.
Yes, I know. They weren't looters. I have read that Goering, at times, when he saw something he really liked, took it for himself. But, you know, that's about as far as what they say. There's no details
I doubt that's true.
Yeah,
I doubt that
right. And I don't think Hitler would have...
It was not allowed. Yeah,
no, it wasn't. Hitler never did that. And that's just why this is such a horrible lie, to constantly accuse him in particular and then all the rest of them of having this, amassing a big art collection which he stole from Jews.
Yeah, I think the basis of that would be he took it for himself after buying it. You know.
Yeah, he did buy it, and he had money too. You know, they want to act like he was, you know, didn't he had money because of the sales of Mein Kampf, for one thing. You know, and his home, the Berghof, he made a point of saying in an interview that it was his home, and he paid for it with his own money and everything about it. You know, so this is a horrible lie, and this movie just carries it further. And the big thing is that this movie is fiction. And Further Glory over there, Scrapbook Pages, he goes to all the movies, particularly movies about Holocaust or World War II, you know, propaganda and so on. He's right there the first day the movie opens. He likes movies, and he always writes a big review of it. And he started right out saying this is not a movie that's going to be in the theaters very long. And I guess those ratings I read show that that's probably true. He said because people aren't going to be able to understand it, young people. Unless you know the whole story of everything, the movie is kind of made up of a few details, and it's hard to figure out why things are happening or you know, all of the background and so on. But it's clearly fiction, and it's based on a book written by Robert M. Edsel, which was published in 2009, and I think his book is titled The Monument Men. I'm not exactly sure, but I think so. And then Edsel's book was based on a book written by someone else, a woman named Miss Lynn H. Nicholas, which her book was entitled The Rape of Europa, and I think she was not so much so much playing up the theft by the Nazis, I'm not sure, but as this Edsel did. But her book was published in 1995, but she may have been just as bad as him. But he says that you couldn't compress all this information into a two-hour movie. And so it's it doesn't really convey any of the truth of things. And then he remarks that George Clooney, who starred in the movie, said in a TV interview that Hitler, just that day that he wrote this, he said he just saw it that morning on a TV show, morning show.
Must be true then.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but he saw George Clooney on that show saying this, mm-hmm. Saying that, yeah, oh, George Clooney. Oh. This is what George thinks. George said that he read the book himself before he started working on the movie, Edsel's book. And that what he learned from that was that Hitler had stolen all the art in Europe and that he was intent upon destroying it.
Oh, wow.
He believes.
You learn something new every day.
And, and then, of course, that the Ghent altarpiece was stored in the Altausi, is how you pronounce that. I don't know if you know. Salt mine in Austria. Altausi, salt mine. Were they?
Oh, yeah. Altausi. Yeah. Probably, yeah.
And they, along with all that other art they put down in there to keep it safe from the bombing.
No, they're going to blow it up later. They have to blow up.
Right. I don't know if this is in the movie. Russian soldiers are shown in the movie, as they watch the Americans gleefully cart off the art treasures found in the Altausi salt mine. So the Americans were taking that out of there. They were the thieves. They were stealing it from the, but they thought, you know, anything that was in Germany they could take.
They were liberating it, Carolyn.
Yeah. And then he says that the Americans were actually stealing it from the Russians because that was the zone that had been promised to the Soviet Union. So before that happened, the Americans got in there and took all that art out of there so it wouldn't go to the Soviet Union, who was going to take control of that zone. Oh, boy. So, the real thieves are always, I mean, and of course we know, and you know, but we'll say here that the real story, and Further Glory says the real story, is that Hitler was planning to create a museum in Linz. No big secret that, in Linz, Austria, where the art of Europe would be displayed, including the Ghent altarpiece, which belonged to Germany. You know, I read somewhere just now that after World War I, the Versailles Treaty ordered that the Ghent altarpiece, that was supposed to be one of the greatest pieces of artwork in the world, in the Western world, that was ordered by the Versailles Treaty that Germany hand that over to Belgium.
Wow.
And now they were getting it back. Hitler wanted to get it back for the German people. And so that's part of, you know, side story there. But they're always stealing. People are always stealing all this stuff, but they want to point to Germany and specifically Hitler and people like Goering and the National Socialists as being the great thieves of art. And we still have today this latest art scandal with that man who's, I've kind of forgotten his name now, but you might remember it. I've written about it, but there's not too much happening about it now, not too much.
Well, Madeleine Albright, didn't she have something that somebody wanted back? Because her family was occupying over there for a while.
Probably. I mean, they encourage every Jew to scan and study and try to find things that belonged to them.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Things that they sold. Yeah, they sold them before the war.
That's right. Yeah. And then they say, well, they sold it under duress. And actually, Germany passed a law and has a law that, oh, I don't have it, you know, the detail of it, but that anything that was sold during the National Socialist period, this is how it went, was considered to have been sold under duress. Can you believe that?
Yeah, so that they get at their own people.
Yeah, that takes in from 1933 on. And if, you know, there are cases all over the world where people feel like they're not safe where they are or they need to leave, and they sell what they can and, you know, whatever they can get for it.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not allowed to come back later and say, well, you know, I didn't get a fair price for this, so people have to hand it back to me. But that's what the Jews have managed to accomplish for themselves.
Yeah.
That whatever they had, and if they sold it, well, they were forced to sell it. They didn't get enough for it. And it has to be
handed. They want it back so they can sell it again if they feel like it.
And they do sell it again.
Yeah.
You know, I had a lot of proof, a lot of instances where as soon as some of these big, well-known, like this one Jewish family got, my problem with remembering names, that Austrian, famous Austrian artist, they got one of his most famous paintings back. And immediately it went on auction and sold for, so many millions. They don't want the artwork. They want to get the money while it's still worth a lot of money. It's just so, this is what we have to deal with. And I said in the mailer that I sent out about today's show that this, and I said it when I was talking about refuting lies, that, you know, you can refute and refute all you want and they're still there. They don't go away. It's like being in a battle zone. That you're in a continual battle zone.
Well, they control the media so much that they have so many outlets to just repeat and repeat it.
That's right. That's right. And so, you know, you wonder why you're doing it, but it's hard to just watch this. It's hard to walk away when there's not enough people, trying to tell the truth and, about these things, and so it's hard to let it go. Well, I sent I linked to this article in the Daily Beast by a Jewish, supposedly he's supposed to be a Jewish art historian, Noah Charney, and he wrote this thing. I've never followed the Daily Beast at all, but I guess it's pretty liberal. And I guess it's pretty, got a lot of Jewish writers. They published this thing and they told all these lies. And here's one I want to bring up. And this even includes Hermann Göring. It says, he wrote, when Monuments Men, Robert Posey and Lincoln Kirstein, walked into the whitewashed cottage in the German forest that housed Hermann Bunge's, the Harvard-educated one-time SS officer and art advisor to Hermann Göring, they learned of an elaborate plan involving the wholesale looting of Europe's art treasures. Bunges, hiding in fear of reprisals against SS officers by angry German citizens, told these fellow art historians about the ERR, the Nazi Art Theft Unit. Well, now, here's two lies already. First, this guy has the nerve to say that the German citizens were angry and would have come and, you know, done something bad to this guy, because he was an SS officer. Boy, you know, I've never seen that before. That's a new one.
Yeah, you always come up with something new.
Gosh, you know, so that.
Yeah, they honored them because they were the best of the best in general.
That's right. That was not happening. That never happened. So, you know, how these people think they can get away with this stuff. And then he says that there was this thing called ERR, and I don't know what that stands for, but it was the Nazi Art Theft Unit, and there was no Nazi Art Theft Unit. There was a unit art to save theft. The art, to get the art and put it in safe places, and they call it a theft. They call it theft.
Yep. But when they actually do steal it, then they're liberating it.
Yes, that's it. That's how the language works. And then he says that the museum in Linz, that Hitler did have these big plans, and Hermann Giesler was the one who was in charge of his Linz not just a renovation, but yeah, a whole city renovation. And Hitler was very involved in that. That's why he and Hermann Giesler spent so much time together working on that. Hitler loved it. He just had this great feeling of affection for Linz. He wanted to make it more important and beautiful, mostly beautiful. And so he thought he would, and he was Austrian too, and he thought he would put his legacy, what he was wanted to be remembered by, all these art museums. And it wasn't just an art museum. It was opera house, you know, symphony, all kinds of cultural institutions were going to be in this area here by the river. And but they're saying that they're taking this whole thing and saying it was a super museum. They call it super. This guy calls it super museum that Hitler wanted to build that would contain every important artwork in the world. Now, there's the third big lie. It was never intended to have everything in the world, but that's what they want to say. And it was huge, but it wasn't. I mean, they say that they take the whole area, this whole cultural area that he had planned out and designed, and they had a model of it and so on. It was very nice, and I haven't checked to see what all the buildings were there, what they were for, but he's making out that whole space, which was... Well, somewhere he's got that, how many acres it was for art, was for painting, like for paintings and sculpture or something, that he was going to have everything in the world. He was going to take all the art from the whole world.
I thought he was going to blow it up.
Well, he was going to do that if he won, but if he lost, it was towards the end. If he lost, he was going to blow everything up. So you kind of like this nasty.
I can't have all the art in the world. Nobody can have it.
Yeah, like the Jews in Israel. Like Israel says, they have that thing. What is that? Samson option.
Samson option.
Yeah. If they're going to be taken down, man, they're going to take everybody else down with them. And they say it and mean it. So then they again do that opposite accusing thing and turn that idea that they, the way they are, onto Adolf Hitler, who loved art and was such a fine man, really, and he never would have done anything like that. But this thing is so full of lies. I mean, it's just incredible. This idea that he was going to take everything that was good in art, all the good art in the world, and then he was also going to have supposedly a wing for the degenerate art to show, and that's so horrible to these people because... they love that. That art is what we're all supposed to honor and love. And so this is, he says, the scale of the collection would have been tremendous, and it would have been curated in a moralistic, pedantic manner, indicating what one should or even must like. But, you know, again, it's the opposite. It's that, you know, Jewish art domination, since it got control, and it goes back pretty far, but it's, you know, really came totally in control. Maybe, I don't know, with the New York abstract expressionism or something. That, you know, that's what they say. You're supposed to like that art. And if you don't, you're just a dummy who has no taste whatsoever. If you reject it, if you want to see, images that are naturalistic or look like things that you recognize, you know, that's totally out. There's something wrong with you. You need to go and take some art history courses and learn something. So there we go. So what else? Do you have anything you'd like to add to the Monuments Man movie?
No, it doesn't sound much like a movie I'd like to see.
No, I will not go and see it. I never go to movies anymore. I haven't gone to movies. The last movie I ever saw was that one about the Aztecs that, what's his name?
Mel Gibson made.
And it was actually very good.
Yes.
I had gone to a movie for a long time before that. I don't watch them at home either. I mean, I don't have a television set even. So I just don't see any of it. I'm boycotting.
Well, you know, I used to watch Turner Classic Movies a lot because I like old movies. But, you know, the more you find out, the more all of those get tainted, too, by what you can see that they're doing.
Right.
Especially some of the early 30s, you know, they're just kind of nice, really some very good comedy. But as it gets closer to World War II, it just gets unbearable. And then afterwards, you have all the Gentleman's Agreement with Gregory Peck, where he's a secret Jew, and you realize how everybody's anti-Semitic, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, et cetera.
Yes. You can watch the whole progress of the Franklin School takeover sort of thing, you know, by looking at the movies.
Exactly.
You can watch how history was moving along and how the media was telling us, what the media was saying to us and so on. Yeah, it's all there. So I guess it's educational if you know how to look at it correctly.
Yeah, if you can stand to have to go through it all.
Right. Well, let's move on then to Hermann Göring, and now it's your turn to take over here. All right.
Okay, well, maybe I'll start out with something that's just directly about Göring himself, and then I'll move to the Gestapo, which is about Vincent Renoir in France wrote an article end of 2006, beginning 2007, wonderful, very long article in defense that is called The Truth About the Gestapo, and it's long overdue because they're still the favorite punching bag of just about everybody, or just the word you use if you want to say some horrible, torturing, sinister organization. But I'll start with something which is just I've thought about for a few years about what did Göring really say. And it's not necessarily a lie about Göring, this quote that you hear all the time. We don't really know if it was a true quote or not. It was taken down by a psychiatrist in the Nuremberg prison when Göring was in prison. And I think everybody's heard this quote. He says, allegedly, naturally, the common people don't want war, neither in Russia nor in England, nor for that matter in Germany. That's understood. But after all, it is the leaders of the country who determine the policy. And it is always a simple matter to drag the people along, whether it is a democracy or a fascist dictatorship, or a parliament, et cetera, et cetera. The people can always be brought to the bidding of the leaders. That's easy. All you have to do is tell them they are being attacked and denounce the peacemakers for lack of patriotism and exposing the country to danger. It works the same in any country. Now, we don't know if he said that or not, but it's sort of like the quote about the big lie. They always talk as if when Hitler talks about the big lie that he's advocating it. There's no evidence that if Göring said this, he was advocating it, of course. He's describing what happens. And he's not describing what Germany does necessarily. He's describing what countries do when they want to drag people into war, such as the Allies in World War II. I was looking at the book this was taken from, which is called Nuremberg Diaries, and it's by Gustav Gilbert, who is a Jewish psychiatrist. And there's actually a sentence that comes before the normal quote, which is interesting. It says, "Why, of course, the people don't want war. Goering shrugged. Why would some poor slob on a farm want to risk his life in a war when the best he can get out of it is to come back to his farm in one piece? Now, that's basically what Muhammad Ali said, come to think of it, when he was talking about why he didn't want to go to Vietnam, you know. You can see that he actually is thinking about what the people really think, you know. Anyway, I want to contrast this, whether he said it or not, and assuming that he didn't approve of this method. We'll see what he really said. No doubt about it. This is official. He said it to a meeting of German and British war veterans. And I'm not sure what the date was. I haven't been able to find that. But this is an official statement of his to the German and British war veterans. He said, "All front fighters fought side by side and went through an inferno. They are all comparable to the heroes of the ancient world. It was the manhood of the nations in their prime who fought and experienced the horrors of modern war. In another war, the flower of the nation's men and women will have to fight. Europe will be destroyed if the best in all of the nations are wiped out. A new conflict will exceed even the ghastly tragedies of the Great War. I believe those who rattle the sabers," and we know that the Jews were rattling the sabers always for another war leading up to World War II. "I believe that those who rattle the sabers have not participated in war. I know that war veterans speak and think differently. They energetically desire to prevent another conflict. I hope that the men who are standing before me can contribute to preserve the peace of the world, a peace of honor and equality for all. Let us not talk of prestige as between the victors and the defeated. This is my one request. Forget what has divided the nations before, and remember that history has advanced." So that was what he really said. There's no doubt about it. Expressing a fervent hope for peace and saying anybody who experienced the Great War would want peace.
Right. Right. Including Adolf Hitler, who said himself that after going through the First World War, he wanted very much to prevent that again, you know.
Yes, and of course the people who were rattling the sabers for war were not people who had engaged in war, as usual.
Right. Yeah.
And they didn't plan to again either. Yep, they always stay very far away after bringing it on. So Goering was also the... of course, he was the head of the Gestapo, which is our next subject. Did you have anything more to say about that?
No. I'm anxious for you to go on.
Okay. Well, this is sort of one of the last remaining taboos, and I helped. I wrote an article for the Barnes Review a couple of years ago, which was a compilation from the work of Vincent Renoir, and this is an interesting work in terms of talking about lies, because a lot of his method in his article is to quote the lies that were told about that were and are told about the Gestapo, and then present you with the truth. And he did it in two parts. The first part was about the Gestapo in Germany before World War II, and then the second part, which was much longer, was the Gestapo mostly in France during the war. And that's a much more difficult topic because they were in a very difficult situation then in terms of the partisans' activities largely and having to find out what's going on. So we can deal with that in another at another time. Today I'm going to talk about just the Gestapo as it existed in Germany during the 30s before the war. And there, the lies that you hear, here's what the U.S. Chief Prosecutor, Robert Jackson, said in his opening statement in the trial against the Gestapo. He says, "Through the police formations that are before you accused as criminal organizations, the Nazi Party leaders instituted a reign of terror. These espionage and police formations were utilized to hunt down every form of opposition and to penalize all nonconformity. And his assistant chimed in. This is Frank B. Wallace. And he called the Gestapo the vicious tools used in the extermination of all opposition, real or potential. Maybe, first of all, I'll just deal with that statement before I go to some of the other parts of this article. Vincent Renoir demolishes that idea that they were penalizing all nonconformity. He just compares the number of Germans who voted against the Enabling Act, which was the act that gave Hitler total power in Germany, basically. 95% or no, I guess less than that. But anyway, let's say, I don't know. But anyway, 5 million anyway voted against the Enabling Act. 5 million.
Out of like 70 million.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know how many of those were actual voters.
Yeah.
So
it's probably right.
Fewer than that. But
that's the population. Yeah.
But at any rate, yeah, so quite a sizable number just did not want it. But yet, you know, a great majority did, and that's why it prevailed. But so if the Gestapo was going to hunt down all opposition and lock them up in concentration camps, you should have 5 million people in concentration camps. But according to somebody's authoritative estimate, I think it was Merkel's in the Nuremberg trials, in 1939 there were 40,000 in the concentration camps in Germany. So somehow they missed about 5 million people who opposed the government. And in fact, I've seen more evidence of that. I have a friend, a German friend, has a wonderful picture that he showed us of a house being built. It was one of the houses that all the Germans got to build for themselves because of Hitler coming into power with loans from the government, which then after they had a certain number of children, the whole loan went away entirely. But this showed, the mother sitting on the step and she's pregnant with what they call a Hitler baby, and his father's up on the roof with him as a little boy, pounding away, building this addition to the house. And this friend of ours, Fritz, said, "What you don't see is my parents were communists, but they're profiting from the government as much as anybody else. They're not sitting there in a concentration camp. They behaved themselves, and they, you know, they were okay. Nobody
That's right. That's right. Nobody was arrested unless there was cause. People were arrested for cause, for breaking laws, for doing things. They weren't going after people because of their political beliefs."
That's right. It was according to their actions.
Right.
Okay, so I'm going to start now at the beginning of this article about what he's refuting here. And this first thing that he's refuting is a lie that there were no political police forces like this in Germany before Hitler came to power. Here's a quote. "The Weimar Republic," this is from Notre Combat, in France, a magazine, obviously anti-fascist. It says, "The Weimar Republic had thought it unnecessary to create a political police force. Hitler's first concern upon his accession to power on 30th January 1933 was to repair this error." Okay, this claim could not be more wrong. There had always been political police. The only difference that happened when Hitler came to power was that the direction of them was centralized. There were political police in all parts of Germany. One of the other big differences before Hitler came to power was that one of their main focuses was to watch over and harass the National Socialist Party. So I mean, they really made their lives a living hell too.
Yes.
But so there was a police force, a political police force beforehand. It was merely centralized under Goering's authority.
Margaret, is there a place on the internet where people can find this article?
I sent it to you, so you can put it up for them, and then they'll be able.
I just have the PDF.
Yes, of the truth about the Gestapo. My article, as I sent it to TBR, actually has more information than this because they had to cut it to fit the space. I can put it up and let you know.
Well, I'm just wondering for the listeners because I'm
can go to the full article, or it's almost the full article of Renoir's, which has been translated by Carlos Porter, and it's a little, you know, he kind of did it in a hurry because he just wanted to do it so it was done, and he, you know, didn't put as much care as he might have if it was a labor of love. It was sort of a labor of duty. But you can find it. If you just go to Carlos Porter's site and search for it, you'll find it.
Okay. He's got a copy of this, so to speak, on his
website. That's the whole Vincent Renoir article. So they can get all this stuff that's left out. There's a whole lot in this article about the conditions before Hitler came to power, which is in order to show why it was necessary to have such a thing as the Gestapo in order to protect the government so that it could function.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Well, they wanted to shut down that government, and they had help from international jury all around the world and money and so on. So that was a big goal of theirs, was to do whatever it would take to bring down his government. And so, he needed to put these people out of commission, and all he did was put them into camps, and they weren't treated that badly. I mean, they weren't they weren't death camps or anything, that's for sure.
Yeah, and plenty of them actually did change their minds. You know, after a while, they're like, why do we need to have a communist party? This is going really well like this.
Well, that's good to hear. Naturally,
which is what the communists were afraid of when he came to power, I would think, you know.
Well, right, because Hitler always wanted to convince the people on the left that he had the better way. He was not against the way they believed, being against, say, the plutocracy or whatever. You know, he didn't see them as hard and fast enemies that could never change, and he was going to get rid of them or something.
That's right. I mean, because after all, National Socialism was a socialist party, and
yes,
no, it was a much better than communism for the workers, in fact, because he didn't create that opposition between the workers and the rest of the society, which is much less productive than a cooperative relationship, which was Hitler's idea. The second big lie about the Gestapo that Vincent addresses here is that the Gestapo was a Nazi organization, a National Socialist organization, and that it was staffed with members of the party. And in fact, I'll just mention briefly here that somehow in the introduction, if anyone downloads the PDF, you'll see that in the introduction to the article in the Barnes Review, it actually states that, and I don't know why it states that. It says, Hermann Göring, the Prussian Minister of the Interior, detached the espionage and political units of the Prussian police and staffed them with thousands of National Socialists. Now, this is an example of something that is not true at all.
I think it must have been taken from Wikipedia.
Yeah, probably, yeah.
Which is a mistake, you see, I don't know. And you didn't get any, you weren't able to write that yourself, so.
I didn't write that, introduction was not written. I didn't see it till later, but anyway.
Okay.
In fact, most of the members of these various police forces that were brought together under one directing head, were just left in place because they were experienced. And what he wanted was police functionaries who had experience.
Professionals,
yeah. And there weren't that many that entered after, actually this says the proportion of volunteers who entered after 1933 only reached at most 10 or 15% of effective staff. That's a very small number entirely, and they're not saying of National Socialists, they're saying of anybody. Mostly it's just the people who already worked for them, and a lot of them had been persecuting the National Socialists, but new regime, they go after the communists, you know. That's the way police work. They work for whoever is the government at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Here's part of the lie. The claim in the Nuremberg indictment that the functionaries and agents were selected, the functionaries and agents of the newly created police force were selected in accordance with Nazi biological, racial, and political theories, completely indoctrinated in Nazi ideology.
Wow.
So no, that's not true. Very big lie.
Wow.
And later some people did join. Some members of the party wanted to join. They had to take the tests just like anybody else and take whatever positions were open, often desk jobs. And there's another thing that often happened later on, but it was mentioned in this part, so I'll mention it, is that later on, they sometimes gave members of the Gestapo an SS rank, and that was in order to give them credibility, especially if they were having to prosecute National Socialists, to give them authority.
Oh.
But they weren't really actually SS members. They were just sort of, they had a title and they had a uniform, which is kind of interesting. In order to strengthen their authority in the discharge of their duties, in particular when acting against National Socialists, they were to appear in uniform.
And who wrote that? Where's that from?
I think that was probably Merkel. It's from the Nuremberg trial.
Okay.
So almost certainly it was Merkel, but it may have been somebody else. If you look, it's got the IMT number in the page, so then you could find who said it.
Uh-huh. All right.
I think it would have been Merkel.
Oh, yeah. Now I see where you're reading from. I'm looking at it right now. I didn't know you were reading from here. All right. I'm in the right place, that means.
Yeah. Okay. Go ahead.
Never. I was going to say something, but it's not important.
Renoir says, well, so some people would ask, why create a Gestapo if it's no different from what there was before? And his answer to that is that it was a defensive organization that was had to be brought, you know, into very tight control so it could be very effective in a time of great, great danger. Because of course, the communists had wanted to be in charge rather than the National Socialists, and they were really, really trying to have a definitive coup before the National Socialists were able to get a firm grip on the reins of government. And so they needed to protect their government, because they had plans for what they wanted to do for the country. And if they weren't able to stand because the communists took them down, then nothing could happen.
Well, look at the FBI, our national police force. They protect the government in all kinds of ways.
Mm-hmm.
We're supposed to think they're there to protect us, but they're really there to protect the establishment as it's currently set up. They all do that.
Mm-hmm.
But they want to make out that the Gestapo, and make it sound like, because it's a German word, that gets some kind of a evil name, you know, or a horrible word, you know.
Gestapo.
Go ahead.
I was trying to remember what it stands for. Geheim Staatspolizei.
Yeah.
Secret state police.
Yeah. Yeah, the fact that they have the word secret in there. Well, the FBI is secret too, but they keep all kinds of secrets, but we don't call them secret.
Mm-hmm.
But I've come across some things where people had dealings with Gestapo investigators and so on, and they seemed to be very polite and very well behaved, and they did not go and break down people's doors and drag people out in the middle of the night. So
exactly.
That's another one of those weird lies.
Yeah. When I went to Catholic University, I was just learning about some of these things. I kept trying to find revisionist materials in their library, which wasn't very easy. But I was reading some sort of from the other side, just anecdotes from people. And I read one from a woman who told of her horrible encounter with the Gestapo, and they came and they did pick her up at like 2 a.m. and took her into the office and interrogated her. And then it's very anticlimactic, and then they took her home.
Well, I'm not saying they wouldn't, maybe.
No, what I'm saying is that there was nothing. It's like you think, oh, something terrible is going to happen. No, nothing. They came, they took her, they interrogated her, she went home.
Yeah, well, that's usually what it was. They're just looking for information. They're checking things out. And most everybody who had to be in, you know, questioned by the Gestapo didn't have any follow-up about it. Although I don't know why they'd come at 2 a.m., but maybe that was the time they thought they'd be sure to find her there. Or
yeah, I don't know.
Them.
it's my recollection that it was some small hour of the morning. Let's see. I just got distracted because someone just asked me, is it true that there was a false statement in the...
So people are sending you Skype messages and...
Yes, I just got a Skype message and I sent something back. So it was a defensive organization. And what Goering said at Nuremberg... Oh, I can't find that now. Oh, well. One of those.
I don't answer anything.
Oh, yeah, here. Here's the big lie about this. In order to make their rule secure from attack and to instill fear in the hearts of the German people, right? Mm-hmm. The Nazi conspirators established and extended a system of terror against opponents and supposed or suspected opponents of the regime. They imprisoned such persons without judicial process, etc. Mm-hmm. Of course, the fact is, number one, they did not imprison them without judicial process. They had to have judicial process before they could put them in a concentration camp. They had a very, as the Germans usually do, they had a very specific system where they had to send it to a judge and have it reviewed before anything could be done.
Yeah, that's partly what I mean by they didn't just go and grab people off the street and throw them into a prison and you never heard from them again. That's the way they say it, you know. People just disappeared and you never heard from them again. That's not true.
Of course, that's theoretically possible here now, I guess, with, with Obama's rulings. Mm-hmm. As long as somebody thinks that we're a terrorist.
Right. Here.
And he talks about the number given as 75,000 Gestapo agents, which sounds like a lot, but then you find that 80% of them are sitting at desks doing various things. So they're just 20% in the field. And when you...
There weren't enough of them.
No, there weren't enough. They could not have surveilled everybody in the country. There's no way.
I don't know if there's even enough of them to do a thorough job.
No,
of what they had to do. See, they really weren't, instead of being a huge amount of the population, there really was too little.
Yeah, though I don't think it mattered too much in Germany before the war because the vast majority of people were in favor of Hitler. Then it was much more of a problem later in France. They really didn't have enough to take care of the problems there. Mm-hmm. Points are, it was a defensive organization. It was not surveilling everywhere, everybody. The Gestapo and the concentration camps, of course, everybody knows that the English had concentration camps for the Boers. It was not an invention of the Third Reich Germans. Mm-hmm. And these concentration camps were not so bad until the very end of the war, you know, when they got extremely bad. And that's another topic that would be interesting to talk about. Who killed those people at the end of the war? Where did those piles of bodies come from? I mean, my thesis is they were murdered by the Allies to create a photo op. But back to the concentration camps of the Gestapo, people couldn't be sent there without any legal preliminaries. And there was also, there were means to appeal if you did not agree with your sentence. They did not have, they were not above the law. So those are sort of the big myths of the Gestapo, I guess. They surveilled everybody. It was a reign of terror. Why would it be a reign of terror? You know, there are very few people that they would be even interested in. And 9 out of 10 of cases of that would be reported would end up being thrown in the waste paper basket, according to the people who seem to have done the research on this.
Well, it just shows that everything that's said about Third Reich Germany and the people running it is just a big lie. I mean, it's almost all a lie.
And yeah, you can default position, you know, you can pretty much say if you read it in about Third Reich Germany, it was probably a lie.
That's very good way. That's put very well. It probably was. So you have to go to revisionist authors to find the truth, because it just isn't out there. Well, gee, come to an end of this just at the right time. We're ready for our break. Let's see. We've had the 60. That was 60 minute, 60 second warning. Now 30 second. All right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, my guest is Margaret Huffstickler, and she's just done a very good job of explaining a little part of the lies that are told about the Third Reich, and including how Goering had somehow created this horrible police agency. And now we're going to go on to this. More lies that are taking place in the white nationalist movement. We'll be back in 5 minutes.
Kamera, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben und bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Nun ist an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Eid. Nimmt im Geiste die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht, wir werden bei euch sein. Ich schwöre dir, so wahr ich hier steh, ich trage die Fahne, wohin ich auch geh. Nie werd ich euch verraten, für kein Geld der Welt. Ich kämpfe für dich, ungebrochener Held. Ich kämpfe für dich, unbekannter Held. Doch ich höre deine Stimme, ich gedanke zu mir sprich. Du Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben und bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Nun ist an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Eid. Nehmt im Geiste die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht,
egal was geschieht,
wir werden bei euch sein. Und wer da noch lügt, euer Namen benutzt, eure Heldentaten durch Geld hier beschmutzt, den trifft das Schwert von unsichtbarer Hand. Ein Totenwächter von Wotan gesandt, ein Totenwächter im schwarzen Gewand. Doch ich höre eine Stimme, die sanft zu mir spricht. Du Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben, bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Zeit, übernimmt unseren Eid, nimm im Geiste die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen, ihr habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein, egal was geschieht, wir werden bei euch sein. Kamerad, du siehst, wir stehen für euch ein, die Kraft, die wir brauchen, Liebe zum Tod an verleihen. Ihr gab so viel für dieses Land. Es war der Glaube, der euch verband. Es war der Glaube, der euch verband. Doch ich höre deine Stimme. Ich darf zu mir sprechen. Du Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben, bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Nun ist an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Eid. Nehmt im Geiste die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht, wir werden bei euch sein. Und kehre ich einst an deinen Stein zurück, berichte ich dir von unserem Glück. Dann ist es geschafft und wir sind wieder frei. Dein Grab blüht wieder, darum ging's mir dabei. Dein Grab blüht wieder, denn jetzt sind wir frei. Doch ich höre deine Stimme, die sanft zu mir spricht. Du Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben und bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Nun ist an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Eid. Nimm dem Geiste die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht, wir werden bei euch sein. Ich höre eine Stimme, die zu mir spricht. Du Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben, bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Und bis an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Halt. Wir sind Geiste, die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht, wir werden bei euch sein.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is the second hour of Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn Yeager. And my guest is Margaret Huffstickler. And we are talking about, we're going to go now into discussing some things that came up on Monday's show, but I thought didn't get quite good enough exposure, and I was trying to do so many things as I usually do. So I've asked Margaret to talk some more and say things that she didn't have a chance to say about the Kevin Strome thread on a Facebook page. I believe it was Michael Weaver's Facebook page that was taken down, but she had copied it before that, and she's put it up on the net as a PDF, and it is linked at my at the mailer that for today's show. You can Google it in some way and you'll come upon it. It is a PDF. And so we're going to spend this hour going into that and then some other things that I want to talk about after this. So, Margaret, are you there now?
Yes, I'm here.
Yeah, I knew you were. So what, you know, there's a lot of significance to this in what we call the white nationalist movement. There's a lot of significance to this argument about that's being made here. And that's why I think it's very important. It goes to a lot of basic issues that we need to deal with, or we need to be aware of, not just let these things go on and pass by. That's what I think.
Yes. I mean, I think honesty is very important in the movement. And, you know, these things, the thing about lies like this, of course, perhaps they're for the purpose is about this national alliance power struggle. But you know, it's not worth it. It's not worth it to lie if that's what it's about. I mean, I don't know if it's about that or if there may be something deeper going on with Rodney. But the thing is that these are not just lies. These are black lies. Well, that's the same as the lies about Germany. They were black lies. They were intended to defame and destroy. And I noticed last week, I was just was looking up something on about this Strom and Rodney Martin and National Alliance Reform and Restoration Group, and I came across this Stormfront post called Default Strom. Somebody wrote, "I just wanted to say that after reading the information, quote unquote, provided by National Alliance Reform and Restoration Group, I wish to remove my support for Strom. I had assumed the charges against him were a frame-up by the enemy, but NARG has convinced me otherwise." Now, the thing is, that shows, you know, this has a lot
now,
of...
Now, NARG is this thing that Jim Ring is...
Yes.
Has instigated in order to take over National Alliance from Eric Gleeby.
That's right, and they're now suing Eric Gleeby, I guess.
And is NARG saying this about Kevin Strom?
Not anymore. It's all been taken down. So I suspect legal, you know, they've heard from somebody because it was absolutely libelous. And that's another sign. I mean, but this person was convinced by it, though it was nothing but lies. Because, I mean, what they had was a document on their page, and then they said what this document said, but it didn't say that. I mean, all you had to do was read the document and see that they were lying, but it was not just lying. It was very vicious lies. You know, it says it was called Kevin Strom's signed consent to pedophile counseling. Now that would, you know, then you assume, well, he must be a pedophile if he's consenting to pedophile counseling, but he's not. So I copied out some of this. I have it on my hard drive. I'm not going to put it up for people to see because apparently people have been taking it down, probably because of some legal notice. So I copied the relevant part of it. And this is where, you know, they say this is a consent to pedophile counseling. So let me read it, the part that's connected to that, so you can see whether any of the listeners think this is a consent to pedophile counseling. It's a it says contract between Kevin and Elisha Strom, and I think it'll be clear that it was not Kevin's idea to do this contract. Okay, it says, "I, Kevin Strom, do hereby enter into contract with Elisha Strom that pursuant to," and he crossed out this before he was willing to sign this document. He crossed out this line. It says, "exposed issues of being a pedophile." That is crossed out. And what he wrote in was concerns related to pedophilia. So that's quite, you know.
Different.
Yeah, and it's obviously Elisha's concerns. Anyway, pursuant to this, "I will maintain ongoing visits with a qualified counselor that handles such issues." And written in, including Harvey Yoder, of the Family Life Resource Center. So he said what he's consenting is to go to a counselor that handles issues related to pedophilia. But that's not pedophile counseling.
Yeah, right. They're trying to find out if he has the traits
of a pedophile.
And if you are already known to be a pedophile, then you go to pedophile counseling.
That's right. But this is to determine. Okay,
yes.
And the next part, and this is where...
And is Harvey Yoder, you know that if he's Jewish or not Jewish?
No, he absolutely is not. He's Mennonite.
Okay, all right.
He's raised in an Amish family, and he's
okay.
And he's strongly... he's a very nice-seeming guy, actually. You can see his blog on the internet, such topics as the advantages of not having a brick-and-mortar church, because you can use more of the contributions to give to charities if you just meet in each other's houses, which is, I guess, how he does it. So, I mean, he's a pretty nice guy, but he's also quite qualified, because I looked all that up, and people can see if they look at the document that I put down his taxonomy numbers, which describe what he's qualified to do, and it includes diagnosing such things as pedophilia. Although that's the opposite of what Rodney Martin says. He absolutely is qualified. But this is this next section is what Rodney Martin drew on to say that Kevin had confessed to being drawn to children. And you'll see also when I read this that he is not confessing to being drawn to children. He is, again, agreeing to go to this counselor. That's all he's doing. So here it says, these visits will be on a twice per month schedule until such time that such qualified counselor will be able to indicate to Elisha Strom that I am free from being sexually drawn to children. Now, did he just admit to being drawn to children?
No.
No. He said he agreed to go to the counselor.
Yeah,
until the counselor wrote something saying that he was free from being drawn to children. Okay, so let's. There's a little bit more, but it's just or drawn to this or drawn to that. Sexually explicit material of children or other characteristics of being a pedophile. So he's going to the counselor until such time as the counselor writes something saying he's free of these characteristics. Okay, now here's the relevant part of what Harvey Yoder actually did write. He wrote, in my professional judgment, I do not see Mr. Strom meeting any of the criteria in the DSM-4 for being a pedophile. So that's extremely, you know, cut and dried. And then
it is, yes.
He says also, I find no credible evidence that he has ever engaged in any inappropriate or illegal sexual or other behavior with any child, male or female.
Wow.
Yeah, so he went to the counselor to receive this clearance saying that he was not a pedophile, and he received it. And this is what is put up on the web by these people under the guidance, it seems, of Rodney Martin. They've now taken it down, realizing that they've gotten themselves in real possible hot water for libel by their characterization of it. But
now, where was this? I didn't see this thing.
Yes, it was on the National Alliance Reform and Reconstitution Group page.
Oh. And they have now let go of that view, and they don't want to hold. I don't know
what their view is, but they don't want to be.
Yes, I see. Right.
Yeah, they don't want to have that up there. So
yeah, because I've heard Rodney Martin say that he confessed to being a pedophile or something like that. You know, that's what Martin said.
And this is the document that he uses to say that he confessed to it.
And didn't he say he confessed three times or something, or is that?
Yeah, so I don't know what the other ones were. Maybe one of them was when he pled guilty to having 8 thumbnails of porn, deleted thumbnails of porn on his computer. Maybe that was supposed to be one of them. But as far as I've seen, he has always denied it. And the Charlottesville Times article said that he had always denied it. So I don't see where the confession could come in the midst of all the denials. I don't know why anybody would want to confess anyway, myself, but.
Yeah. Well, he did this plea agreement thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's where all that comes from.
Yes.
And so are you going to explain that next or whatever?
Yes. Well, and this is another of the arguments that says it's hard to believe that he could possibly be a pedophile because the court awarded custody of his children to him.
After that hearing and stuff.
Yes, he was awarded custody of his children.
Did he have to plead some kind of plea? He pled what?
I should look back.
Why didn't they just let him go? I mean, why do they make?
Well, for one thing, I think these people are, you know, the feds when they're after this kind of case are very persistent. You know, the judge threw out quite a bit of things, but I think that there may be also a requisite something for this child porn thing, like a no tolerance thing. I'm pulling up right now this Charlottesville Times article because it said a little bit more about that. It's the Charlottesville Times, and if anybody wants to read this article, it's you just put Charlottesville Times and Strom, and you'll come up with this article called "The Kevin Alfred Strom Case." It says child porn. Let's see. Like heroin and cocaine, child porn has been made very easy to convict on. In fact, one need not even know one is in possession to be convicted. Hidden in clauses of bills like DMCA are items making the reception, even if unsolicited or unknown, of child porn an actionable criminal offense.
That's kind of crazy, isn't it?
Yeah, it's pretty.
I mean, how does that, did they mean that, do they think that if you didn't somehow go and look on a porn site or something, that you wouldn't have anything in your computer that you didn't ask to have there? That how does that work?
I don't know. I mean, they've got to know that people have things, you know, thrown on their computer very often, you know, from sites mm-hmm. they didn't want it from. And these eight thumbnails that he pled to, as far as I know, were immediately deleted. And, or I don't know about the thing that the defender of Kevin Strom that I first read in Stormfront, who also replied to this Charlottesville article, says that he hadn't been in his house. This was Elisha's house, I guess, and he hadn't been there for 5 months before this came up, or with the computer in his possession. It says half of the file, the eight files, had last modified dates after Strom had left the home. And the rest were thumbnail-sized ads from some forum, all of which were deleted, and that Strom didn't even have possession of or access to the computer in question for over 5 months before he was charged. So it was all very questionable, but I guess it is sort of obligatory once they start the process in motion that if you have it on your computer, then you're guilty.
You know, I wonder why they don't make pornography illegal. They don't. I mean, these people are producing it and putting it out there, and they're safe. But if anybody looks at it, well, I guess child porn. Okay.
Yeah, that's the child porn. But
child porn is a different matter, right? Yeah.
Yeah, but anyway, well, so that's a very good thing to be able to charge people with. In fact, it's funny, this morning, I won't mention any names about this, but somebody who had been sort of on the warpath against Kevin for this suddenly got some texts from a disgruntled female that he knew from Facebook saying that he was going to find some child porn on his computer. I think it's a little poetic justice there. You know, maybe he's starting to see what can happen to you. I mean, I don't think it's going to happen. Hopefully not. I wouldn't wish it on anyone. But to think that you have to be guilty for this to happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, you don't. You mean you don't have to be guilty for this to happen?
No. It's easy to plant. I mean, that was one of the main things that the Charlottesville article was saying. It's just it's like heroin. He's saying it's like heroin or cocaine. You know, that the cops just throw a baggie in your car and then say, you know, then throw you in prison, you know, mm-hmm. just put a little porn on your computer and there you are. So he had no choice but to plead guilty to something, and unless he wanted to go to trial and possibly be in prison for 10 years, and he didn't want to be away from his children for 10 years, possibly. He knew that if he pled guilty to this, it was small enough so that he would be out fairly short time and could be back with his children.
Well, he was never imprisoned, was he? Or was he?
He was. He served out his sentence for this.
What was the sentence? How long?
I'm not sure.
Oh. What did he plead guilty to?
Let me see. I don't have that. It was to inadvertent possession of some
thumbnails.
Yeah.
All that was in there. that to show how minor it was. And I guess he thought, but he's not on, is he on some kind of a list?
Yeah, I think you have, I think that's required also.
And so he agreed to be on a pedophile list.
He
be on a list of pedophiles. See, that I think was not very smart.
Well, you know, I mean, I don't know what choice he had except to be away from his children for possibly many years. I think maybe he's hoping to get that changed. I mean, the fact that those things were taken down at the NARC site makes me think he's not just sitting back, but trying to get the record changed.
Excuse me. So does he have custody of his children now?
Yes, he has custody.
Well, that's strange. Now, that's really wild. Now, here he's on a pedophile list, and then he has custody of his own children.
That's
right.
How
old are they?
I think they're like 11 and 15 and 13 or something like that.
Three of them.
Mm-hmm. Three children.
And what happened to Alicia, Mother Alicia? Where did she go?
I don't know what's happening to her now, but, you know, she was in jail for a little while because she was... one of the things that came out in this case was that she was having an affair with the investigating officer. Though I guess the officer denies it, but she certainly said very explicitly that she had. And I mean, she's a little bit.
Maybe she's another compulsive liar.
Yeah, she's either a compulsive liar or a very vengeful woman. You know who. Who's also a loose cannon. I think that on that document with the debate, there's a URL people can go to if they're interested, or you could even find it from the Charlottesville Times article. There's some URLs at the bottom. The URL that says more evidence of my innocence. If you follow that far enough, you can find, his wife's blog about her policeman lovers, plural. Anyway, she's. I would not put a lot of faith in her.
So he's there. He is a father who cares about his children, has custody of his children, and he's hoping to remove this stain. From his name, and I imagine his children would like it to be removed too.
I should think so. Yeah.
Maybe when they get a little older, they could have more influence on it and speak up for him.
That's true. Yeah.
Well, I don't. You know, it's a kind of a tragedy. Now, if unless you have something more you want to say about that, which is fine, we could talk about why Rodney is so. Gone after this the way he has.
Yeah, and also I'll just say a couple of things again about the way he did it was so, well, because there isn't really a case for what he was saying, and so he kept going to these tactics that were just distract, insult, and he would have things like he would have pages about what the proper treatment for pedophiles is, what the accepted treatment. And that has nothing, it's irrelevant unless he was a pedophile, you know, and it's irrelevant for proving that he was, that Kevin was. So these tactics are very strange. Okay, that's all I'll say.
Well, yeah, you wanted to say that you thought they were, you had stronger words than that in the beginning for the way he has done this. I don't remember now what they were. But
well, it just reminds me of people working for the other side. He was definitely... pushing the government's case, which had been thrown out of court, most of the stuff that he was using. And then those tactics, they're like when you're talking to some Jewish Holocaust defender or something, the way they just will bring in anything, including the kitchen sink, just to keep arguing. But, you know, I mean, yes, I said some more extreme things, like maybe he's still working for the government.
Oh,
but,
I didn't remember that. I was just meant that, you know, the way that he did it was so, I don't know, I guess lying, you know, telling lies and not wanting to hear any. Well, one thing I can say right now, though, is that there, I know quite a few people who have been very anti Kevin Strom since this, and say we don't want anything to do with Kevin Strom, and someone on your network is defending Kevin Strom, and this person said he wasn't actually defending; he was pointing out the facts of the case, which is kind of his thing that he does. You know, this is Hadding Scott. He's always coming in on conversations and pointing out the facts and trying to straighten people out if they don't have the facts he thinks they should have. So, but you know, people, there's a lot of a feeling about this where people have gotten this wrong idea that he has to be, has to have messed with children or bothered children or has
no smoke
or at least
fire.
has this unhealthy attraction to children. Mm-hmm.
Which I haven't seen the evidence for, and the Yoder specifically said that he hadn't seen evidence of any inappropriate conduct, any credible evidence, which was interesting. So that would even include non-sexual. He said sexual or otherwise. Mm-hmm. So it really, there are a lot of stuff could have been just made up.
Yes. Well, rather than go into all those details again, and we're kind of running out of time a little bit anyway, so as soon as I start going on like that, I forget what my thought was. That's how fast I forget things.
Well,
go ahead.
I was just going to say that he's been telling some lies, or somebody under his control has been telling some lies about you recently, I think.
Oh, yeah. Well, we're going to get into that, but let's just finish this up. Could it be that that he is really concerned about the health of the movement, or could it be that once Kevin Strom came out with this new idea of a national alliance that they want to put together, and he seems to have been wrapping himself up even before that William Pierce, and wants to associate himself with this Jim Ring, who you say does not want to lead any new national alliance. He's just trying to get rid of Gleevee and put somebody else in charge or something. But that Rodney Martin seems to always be presenting himself as the leader, and he says he doesn't want to lead it either. Nobody wants to lead, but people want to say how it should be done, you know, and what way it should be. There's that that it's just a callous move to put oneself in a good position and put the opposite, the people you don't like, in a bad position. And further than that, when he keeps saying, He won't ever change his mind. I mean, he's still saying on his own programs and on his network there that people. In fact, he said on his show last week or this week that that these two females, meaning you and I, were on the program defending this pedophile. Strom, if you mentioned his name, and and we don't want that in this movement, and you know, this is just terrible. We have to clean this movement up from all
I like it. He always likes
and all this stuff.
He's always trying to do that. You know, we got to clean out the movement. We're going to divide it in two parts: the ones who are acceptable and the ones who are just trash. You know.
Yeah, but that's new. See, because before his whole thing was to bring everybody together, even if they didn't think exactly the same way. You know, he was the one who was all for unity, and he was trying to get different people on his programs. And if any of them were criticized for being not quite up to snuff, according to, you know, certain people's ideas, well, that's all right, because you can't, you know, we got to work with everybody, and we can't be, you know, putting people out because they don't think just the way you want them to. And now that this other stuff has come up about his past, he's, and all that's been happening about it, he's now moved over to where he's saying the opposite of what he used to say, which is that now we have to divide, and he doesn't like the word white nationalism anymore. He just came up with that. I'm going to come up with a new term for the good people and the healthy white people and family-minded people and so on, and get rid of all this manure. We're going to put up a fence. And he talks real big, you know, like he's in charge. And you know, I notice that there's not even any comments to those shows. Nobody's listening, you know, but he's talking real tough. So I guess I'll go on with some of these things I want to bring up. And, you know, it's, I waited till the end, but it's still not easy to break into this, because there is a kind of a code of not putting down one another and so on. But I think that we've gone into a time where we've got so much, we're not getting anywhere, and we've got so much disagreements. And I myself am the one who is willing to speak up about what I see, and which most people will not do. And so then I get a reputation for, or people are trying to give me a reputation for being a big troublemaker. And there are a lot of people who see it that way, but I'm going to go and make some more trouble here right now. Uh-huh. And I'm just going to start out, since we're talking about lies, that there's two things that I want to bring up here right off the bat, which are just individual items. And that is that Rodney Martin continues to say that, continues to refer whenever he's talking about any of this, that about those people that attack my wife, you know, and when this person attacks my wife and children, he's referring to me. And, you know, this right here is not the truth. But he wants to say that. He wants people to believe it. But I have never attacked his wife. You see, I've said this before, but I'm going to say it again here for people to really listen to. And I've certainly never attacked his children. All I did was show what was in that newspaper article, what it said about his wife, that he did not argue about at the time. He didn't have it removed. He didn't do anything about it. It was consent. As I said previously, I have now seen a picture of his family, and now I'm going to say this, Margaret. I thought, well, it's not up to me to publish this picture of his family. You know, that's not, if he doesn't want to publish it. But, you know, now he's also going on and on more about how he's going to be at Freedom Palooza, and people can come there and meet him and meet his wife. Not ever, you know, mentioning that it's in Pennsylvania in July and August, or 1st of August or something, and that all these people from all over the country and the world maybe are supposed to travel there in order to meet him and apologize to his wife.
Yeah, wouldn't it be easier to post a picture?
Yeah, it's like he's setting this thing up where people have to go there. And if they don't go there, he's already calling the people who don't show up there cowards, and who aren't going because they, you know, want to continue to tell lies and so on. I mean, it's just so incredibly crazy. No intelligent person would think that they could get away with schemes like this, but he does. And so just to say, you know, that the one who attacked his wife was him. He had to have said that to the newspaper reporter in the interview, that his wife was Cherokee, Eastern Cherokee. And maybe she is partly in some way, who knows. But it was never removed in all these years. And certainly if it was a mistake, there would have been a disclaimer. And he could point to all these things. And he tells these fantastic stories about why it wasn't. But anyway, but to go on about another one, on one of these recent programs, David Bailey said in the program that Hitler was a brunette. Now, this might not be a very big thing, but Hitler was not a brunette. And most people don't know what brunettes are. You know, I guess some people might think if you're not blonde, you're a brunette. But a brunette has very dark hair and often dark eyes. And, not Hitler had light brown hair, even though in so many photographs it looks dark, because that's the way these photographs come out.
Yeah,
you know?
Yes, that's one reason models often blonde their hair, because hair tends to photograph darker than it is. You know, Lothrop Stoddard, in his book Into the Darkness, writes about meeting Hitler, and it's interesting. He says he has dark blonde hair, which was a surprise to me. But, you know, if it's medium brown, maybe it looked blondish to him. But it certainly was not, I agree with you, dark brown.
No, no. And if you see pictures of him, like in the sunlight or whatever, you see, call him a dark blonde, but just the regular, there's so many Germans with that color hair, you know, just a kind of a medium brown, somewhere from lighter to a little bit darker, but, you know, just a medium brown. It would be a brownette. That's very, very common among Germans. That's another thing that circulates. I hear it said a lot by people that he had black hair sometimes, but, or that, you know, he had dark brown hair. Well, it wasn't. So, and I guess these are things that people just think it's not very important, so let it go. But I think it's important, because it seems for some people they say it because they want to turn Hitler into a very un-Nordic or even un-Aryan person. You know, they want to say, well, he had this dark hair, or they want to associate him with Mediterraneans or something. And that's just, it's just, the fact is, it's just not true. Well, now, I'm going to talk now about Christopher John Vorsella, who is a part of the American Nationalist Association network, and has been joining in with Rodney and others in making a lot of comments about me and a lot of put downs about me. And I'm saying it in relationship to this Larry Symes Facebook page, which I'm really not encouraging people to go find that. But still, I think it would be a small number of people who would, where he has written positive comments about this defamatory Facebook page that supposedly somebody named Larry Symes has put up, which I'm sure that Rodney is behind it. Or and in some way or another, if he hasn't done it himself. And so apart from what's on there, I have been looking into Vorsella, who has emailed me in the past in a very nasty way, and I'm going to cover all of that. So let me just move along with this. You know, I see Mr. Vorsella in the mode of Jack Donovan, the macho homosexual male over at Countercurrents, and Vorsella recently said that some of the people he liked or whatever should be read were Rene Guénon and Julius Evola, two men who are writers who are very important to the crowd over at Countercurrents. And they are associated with this, especially Julius Evola, with the Imperium idea. And I am suspicious of Vorsella, although I'm not saying that he is homosexual, but he is certainly in the mode of being a tough-talking male who is 35 years old. If he's not 35 yet, he's 34 going on 35, and because it's only February of this year. But he is listed and has been for a long, long time as living at an address in New York that is the exact same address of his two parents, and also the same phone number. So I take it that he's been living at home all this time with his parents and has never gone out on his own. And I've looked on quite a number of forums and different things that are on the internet that some people are helping me to find. I will say that, because I don't have the time to look for all this, but I did find a few things on my own yesterday. But and he never talks about a girlfriend or a woman, you know. In one thing here, and also, let me just throw this in here, Riverhead is on Long Island, And it's Long Island is known to have a lot of Jews living there, and a lot of Italians too. And as of the 2000 census, it was I had that here, but it had a high number of Jewish citizens, Jewish residents, but I only mention that because he's not Jewish, I don't think, but they keep saying that my former husband is Jewish because of his name, and then because he grew up in New Jersey, and then he was living in Florida, Palm Beach County mainly, for a long time. That's in fact where we met and were married, but then we left there just a few months later and never lived there again, but he went back there later on, that somehow makes him Jewish, you see. But Borsella lives on Long Island and works at the United Nations, or did up until whenever he stopped working there, if he doesn't anymore. And David Bailey, another one of their little crowd there, is in Boston, is from Boston. And even the Rizzoli brothers are from a very highly Jewish town in Massachusetts. That doesn't mean that they're Jewish, nor does anybody think that they're Jewish. So this kind of connecting people, you know, in this stupid way is so ridiculous. And you think that they would be embarrassed to do it, but they don't. They're not embarrassed. Now, see where I can, if I left something out here. Borsella wrote a book. He's written three books now. And the most popular one, I guess, is Fascist Italy in 2007. And in 2007, he was like 28 or 29 years old, something like that. And he dedicated the book to Mom and Dad. Thanks. Well, you know, when I read that, I thought, well, sure, they supported him while he wrote his book, and they still do when he lives with them. So he gave them some thanks in his book dedication. And he has been a member of an IAU, Italian American United Forum. And in 2007, he was writing on there a lot. And he writes a lot about, well, he wrote this. Okay, I'm going to read this, something he put on there. His name was always Christo Gianni, an Italian spelling that he has changed into Christopher John. And so Christo Gianni is one word, but he signs these things generally Christo. And he wrote here in 2007, when people say gay rights in today's day and age, they explicitly mean gay marriage or gay bashing. Physical and verbal attack is wrong, no matter who it is aimed at. He does a lot of verbal attack. I don't know about physical, if he feels like it, but, and I've got some examples of that coming up, but he's saying here that he thinks it's wrong. And I'm only sorry, he says, that some of the people on this site do not understand that yet, despite their many years of alleged wisdom. But the right to marry is a different issue for me and many others. Furthermore, I take great offense when some compare the gay struggle to the struggle faced by blacks and other minorities during the civil rights era. They are as different as night and day. When were gay people ever snatched from their homeland en masse and transported to an alien world? When was a gay person ever considered three-fifths human? You know, that's what Negroes were back while they were still in slavery time, or what they wanted to consider them after they were freed in the South. And then he objects to all of that. He's defending he's defending that when you know, he's defending the blacks, and he's very very anti-slavery and so on. He goes on saying, "When was someone gay ever enslaved in this country? When was there ever separate public facilities and transportation?" The answer, never. So he's very, you know, he's going, coming out very strongly against what was done to the Negroes. But he's not defending gays. There are some gays, some gay men on this forum, and he seems to get into arguments with them, and they don't like him either. So he's could be posing, or he's just not gay, but he's still not ever settled down with anybody. Conversely, what is the average annual income of homosexuals? What is the percentage of homosexuals on death row and living in urban ghettos? I think we all know the answer to these questions. So am I a fascist? I would like to hear from Giampiero, who is the one who says he's a homosexual, on this matter, especially since he is someone who has specifically stated that he is openly gay. Regards, Christo. Well, there's some others here. He's talking about his father being in the North Africa or East Africa in the Navy in the late 60s. And he says, if you only knew what the poor Italian peasants were fighting for in this region of the earth, like the landscape of Mars, and did you know that Mussolini's African colonies received railroad lines before many parts of Italy's rural south did? That was the great, in sneer quotes, the great Duce's legacy. He doesn't sound to be saying anything very nice about the Duce there. And then he goes on also to argue with this Giampiero, and he says to him, hey, sissy boy, Giampiero says he's tougher than Christo. Christo says, hey, sissy boy, I'd break you in half, or better yet, into a million particles and rip up your PhD right in front of your German-looking head. You look like an Aryan. Now, that's supposed to be an insult, obviously, on this Italian forum. You're talking to an amateur boxer, girl. My chest alone is twice the size of your torso. Come out to New York. We'll see how tough you are. Damn right, I'm straight. And he signs it. And he says, no, I'm saying here, he had said that everyone knows he used to be a UN executive. He's been listed as working in the procurement department at the UN, but he's called himself an executive. Now here he's on, the same forum, and he's writing to a girl who came on, and, she's asking about dual citizenship to be a citizen of Italy. And he says, good for you. Dual citizenship is the way to go. I'm still working on mine. Then he gets into an argument with another woman and talks quite rudely to her. And he's always talking to men, but when he gets involved with women, he has a hard time. And on this site, he said he was having this exchange with Teresa. His family is from Naples, Bari, and Campobasso. Those are all in southern Italy. You know that there's a big division between North Italy and South Italy, and the northern Italians would like to even break away from the southern Italians. The southern Italy is where there's a lot more race mixture going on. And there's several pictures of Christo Gianni Borsella that are available. He has a shaved head, and he has a fancy little hair design growing around his mouth. Not really a beard or anything. Not even a mustache, but some kind of design of hair. And, he looks gay to me. And other people have said that. But still, he talks like he is not. Now, next thing coming up here is that his first or second book, he wrote one book that's kind of very unknown, but this one is called On Persecution, Identity, and Activism. And it says It's a definitive work on the many trials and tribulations that American Italians have suffered over the past 120 years. He's very identified as Italian. And of course, Long Island has a lot of Italians, and he's lived amongst Italians and calls himself by this very Italian name. And then he says that the great bulk of persecution, not he said, but the thing on this book, this is at a book sales place, the bookstore on the net, writing about his book, so I'm sure he approved of this. His work encompasses the great bulk of persecution that existed in the United States through the use of a historical timeline. And in a few more sentences, then he says, due to the striking similarities between Italian immigrants of the past and immigrants of the present, on persecution, identity, and activism is truly a must read for anyone wishing to better understand the vexing immigration questions of our own times. Now, he seems to have been pro immigration, or very sympathetic to the immigrants. And I'm looking back here to see if I passed up this link to something I wanted to go to. I guess not, because I've got all these things that he wrote to Teresa. But I think I'm going to go here. All right, here it is. To this site, Poetic Diversity. And there's a whole page by Cristo Gianni Borsella from 2005. And it describes him here, his bio. He was very active in all these chatty places, you know. This is poets, contributing poets. This is poets who are for diversity. So Cristo Gianni Borsella is a 25-year-old native of Long Island, New York. He is involved in various multicultural organizations and is deeply committed to anti-racist causes. Currently, Cristo is a student at SUNY Empire State College, pursuing a bachelor's degree, blah, blah. Anyway, they have a poem. He was recently interviewed. Okay. His highest hope is that his writings will positively affect the troubled world around him. Now, there's a poem he wrote, and it's titled Jesus of Riverhead. This is the one he has on his site here, on his page. And this is what he wrote, and it's obviously about an illegal immigrant that is hanging around in one of these corner areas or mall areas or whatever for people to come by and hire them for the day for, you know, employment. And he's calling this person Jesus of Riverhead. His poem goes, there he is, standing on the corner of Griffin and Main, near the store that sells those colorful flags to colorful people of Mayan and Aztec descent, the progeny of living gods now working like slaves. His blue and white flannel shirt sticks to his torso like a defiant Honduran banner, one that's losing the battle, but has too many soldiers in the field to raise the white flag. There's still a lot of fight left in this man, too much of the rugged peasant in him, fierce in his anger, simple in his ways. He'll never give up, never surrender. He'll never know defeat, even when he loses big and everything around him fades into darkness. The little man will keep coming back, pure of heart, with dusky face, his dreams outshining his reality. There he'll be, picking in Baiting Hollow, washing cars on 58, thinking of home, a life-serving faith. Someday things will change for sure, and wealth will come his way. Just maybe his descendants won't learn to persecute others, but they probably will. For now he'll stand firmly, like a granite shrine to the proletariat, looking for work on Griffin and Main. Well, that was in 2005, and people change, but it seems that he and Rodney Martin had a lot in common during that time, in 2007, and up till when was it that they really changed, and why? And they don't talk about it very clearly as to what happened to them. And I've got some more here. Yeah, that this high, and this one thing from 2007 or 8, another little blurb about him because of his book selling. He calls himself a historian, and it says Christo's hobbies include. Now, this is when he was 28 years old. His hobbies include boxing, spending time with his dog, Fella, listening to world music, and, of course, reading and writing. He's currently employed by the United Nations Procurement Service. So he spends time with his dog, but it doesn't say he spends time with his girlfriend or, you know, anything like that. So it sounds like kind of a loner. There's a bunch of stuff about his books there. So I take it, now I got some emails from him, and his email address was cmi_1979@yahoo.com, and I thought, 1979, that sounds like it could be his year of birth. And I, you know, added it up, and yeah, using 79 as his year of birth, he's now 35. Or will be soon. So that fits. I'm sure that's correct. And back in January 1st, 2014, because of a comment I wrote at the Daily Stormer about his radio program, which was published there under the radio things, and many people, there were a number of comments there, and many of them were critical. There wasn't a lot of them, but I would say, you know, there might have been four that were critical of the person he had on that show, which was under discussion. And I added my comment that this was often, that this program of his often had these kind of wimpy people. I don't know how to say wimpy, but these people that didn't stand strongly for, were kind of, were kind of compromised people. And he took offense at my comment, whereas I don't believe he took offense at anybody else's comment, but probably because I'm a woman and he knew, you know, from my name that I was a woman. And so he, and next thing I know, on January 1st, I'm getting emails from him. Some people, so he already knew Rodney Martin and had gotten off of his network. Later he got back on his network, but he writes to me first. Let's see, is this the first one? Yeah, I hear now this in large letters. I hear your womb is barren. That explains a lot. Overcompensating for your inferior DNA. Of course, as I said, he's neopop. Said, like so many school teachers and biker girls, I find it interesting how you believe you're in a position to give others advice. You're a barren old spinster, a failed woman, plain and simple. I doubt you even know how to cook. Pathetic. And then the next one is, I won't even read that one, but it, the last one, he leaves something at the fourth one. I got fourth one. He ends up with, leave being an intellectual to those qualified. Keep your day job, Grandma. Now get in the kitchen and make me a sandwich. See, now I wanted to point out that this is how these Imperium guys think. They're very anti-woman, and they don't have any useful women unless they can dominate them, and they think that women should just be producing babies. And so women like Margaret and I, who neither one of us have had children, are objects of hatred. So I barely got this. I didn't get to finish this very well, but Margaret, thank you very much for being here.
Yes. Thank you for having me.
Sorry you didn't get to contribute to the last part there. All right, ladies and gentlemen. See you next time.
Thanks for listening. And be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.